The following is for your ears only. On Air, the new name for Newsweek On Air. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Libya and terrorism, what the rebellion, Gaddafi's repression, and the West's response may mean for al-Qaeda's plans there and elsewhere.
Politics and the budget, the role of Tea Party freshmen and White House contenders, including current occupant Obama.
Afghanistan, the re-rethinking, after more deadly accidents, less progress than some thought promised, and the growing budget crunch.
Kicking the Beehive. After exploring American standards and agnostic gospel, singer-songwriter Susan Werner returns to country roots.
MS in the mind. At the start of Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, some advice on the psychological side effects.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of March 6th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
In the years ahead, Libya could become a peaceful democracy, or it could face protracted civil war, or it could descend into chaos. The stakes are high.
It's very, very unclear who the leaders are and who they represent. A mixture of tribal groups, those who favor the old monarchy. I mean, there's a real mixture there.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton before the House Foreign Affairs Committee last week, and Mideast expert Richard Downey of Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies talking to the AP. Indeed, the unknowns in Libya only grew as pro- and anti-Gaddafi forces battled for control, and the situation came closer to outright civil war than any of the region's other recent uprisings. There were both greater impact on the outside world in the form of spiking oil prices that could threaten U.S. economic recovery, and greater debate over outside military intervention, most notably imposition of a no-fly zone to prevent more Gaddafi air attacks on his own people.
Another unknown is the degree to which developments in Libya already involve or will affect the continuing threat of al-Qaeda and the other Islamist terror groups it has inspired. To consider all those factors, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Waleed Faris, professor of global strategies at the National Defense University, advisor to the Anti-Terrorism Caucus in the House of Representatives, and author, most recently and foresightedly, of The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East, from Threshold Editions. Its cover photo of jubilant demonstrators looks something right out of the news. Dr. Faris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
The initial Mideast uprising starting in Tunisia seemed to bear out your forecast of impending youth-driven regime change without resort to terrorism. What's your first reaction?
Well, my first reaction was that the book's analysis and projections really materialized very fast, faster than imagination. It's true that I wrote the whole book to make the case that revolutions are coming to the region, that civil societies are about to rise against authoritarian regimes. But the speed with which the revolt in Tunisia took place and was successful, then the speed with which Egypt followed in its own rapid change, then the demonstrations hitting many other countries by the day, Bahrain, Iran, Jordan, Algeria, and even northern Sudan, all that was amazing to watch. It is something to watch, you know, your predictions actually happening. There are no other words to describe it. Even events in Libya today are hard to believe that they are happening, although projected.
What is it about the Gaddafi regime that has moved the uprising there more towards civil war?
In contrast with the armed forces of Tunisia and Egypt, the Libyan army wasn't connected to the West or to the United States. In Egypt and Tunisia, military leaders understood that they need to side with the people in the age of Internet and, of course, in the age of international justice. In Libya, there is, you know, a highly ideological security service. As in Iran, it's part of the regime. It profits from the regime. But also large segments of the Libyan military chose to side with the demonstrators. Then you have the current different situation, a civil war.
Given Gaddafi's four decades of repression, what can you tell us about the relative organization and influence of Islamist groups there, Libya's counterpart to Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood?
You know, it's interesting that the classical Islamists, including the Muslim Brotherhood, which I differentiate from the jihadists of bin Laden, they've adopted similar strategies across the Arab world, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya. What they've done is that they pushed the NGOs, the youth, they call them the Shabab, the bloggers, the liberals, first, because the latter has a good image internationally. So what we saw basically is little of Islamist slogans displayed in the start. The bulk of activities by, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood or the Islamists is in organization, in local areas, seizing the media, and more importantly, in being part of the military preparations. For example, here in Libya, the Islamists are everywhere in the background, and you can see them even on TV getting the training from the officers. So they're getting ready for the next stage.
You've also said that the chaos building in Libya makes an inviting opening to Islamist extremists from outside.
Oh, no doubt about it. Al-Qaeda, particularly Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Aqim, these guys are already inside the country, and one can project that they are now seizing the golden opportunity to infiltrate from everywhere, from Algeria, the Fezzan province in Tunisia, and also mostly from the Great Sahel in the south. So civil war in Libya will permit Aqim, the local regional branch of Al-Qaeda, to deeply deploy inside Libya.
There were also reports last week of fear that weapons liberated from the Libyan military, including those shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles, will end up in the hands of outside terrorists, a significant threat to military and civilian planes worldwide. Can you talk a bit about that?
Of course. As was the case in Afghanistan in the 90s, weapons, including short-range missiles, I'd say, but also anti-aircraft missiles, and even possible components of biochemicals still in the hands of the Libyans. This kind of material may fall into the hands of terrorists or radicals, factions who work with Gaddafi in Africa, factions that are controlled by the Islamists, but of course, and the most dangerously, Al-Qaeda. This is a very dangerous mixing of radicals, and Libya's depot, I may say, are among the most dangerous on the planet today.
On the debate over outside intervention against Gaddafi, some rebel leaders are calling for direct attacks on his strongholds, others for a no-fly zone, which Defense Secretary Gates says would require at least enough air assaults to neutralize government air defenses, an act of war. What's your view on what realistically can and should be done and by whom?
I've made the case with members of Congress and European Parliament and also on Arab TV that the opposition in Libya must first of all come forward with one plan, one demand. You know, some have been calling for strikes, others for no-fly zones, and others, the Islamists, for example, have been saying we don't want to see any foreign force in Libya or in the skies. So the opposition needs to make up its own mind because each option has its own drama. For example, not intervening against Gaddafi will stretch the humanitarian crisis long. Striking Gaddafi's military positions is an act of war, yeah, and has consequences. And a no-fly zone can also be transformed into a war. So the actual opposition must make its intention known. Otherwise, the international community will wait for more drama, and then it would intervene under Chapter 7 of the United Nations.
Meanwhile, I've seen an interesting story in the paper this weekend that not a no-fly zone, but aerial positioning of cell phone bases might help the opposition by permitting them to overcome the kind of communications blackout Gaddafi has enforced and connect them with the outside world in a way that they haven't been most recently. You think that might be an interesting approach?
All these approaches are interesting. Anything that has to do with an international strategy to empower civil society to identify, you know, what we call now the democratic forces in Libya that are not very clear, as is the case in Libya, I mean in Tunisia and in Egypt, that is what we have to do. And indeed, technology will be extremely helpful. Let's remember that most of these revolutions have profited from SMS in Lebanon, from Twitter in Iran, from Facebook in Egypt, and maybe the cell phone could work in Libya.
All in all, do you see current ferment in the region sidelining al-Qaeda and the terrorist appeal or accomplishing its goals for regime change and creating openings for its operatives and converts?
Look, in conclusion, it all depends on our readiness. If we reach out to civil societies, they can marginalize al-Qaeda's ideology. If we leave the people of the region to the mercy of radicals or Islamists, as some are arguing in D.C., we're going to end up with Islamist regimes, al-Qaeda, and oppressed societies across the board, and future revolutions to come.
Dr. Waleed Faris is professor of global strategies at the National Defense University, advisor to the Anti-Terrorism Caucus in the House of Representatives, and author most recently of The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East from Threshold Editions.
Quote from the news, "We love the same things, we believe in the same things." That was Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas defending his wife's ongoing work against health care reform as Democratic lawmakers again called for his recusal on likely Supreme Court consideration of the issue.
Next, the budget battle brewing in Washington and the politics around it. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern.
Even as we cut back on those things that don't add to growth or opportunity for our people, we have to keep investing in those things that are absolutely necessary to America's success. Education, innovation, infrastructure.
You could argue that $4 billion in the context of an over $3 trillion budget is not a lot of money. It is at least the first time since I've been here that I can recall cutting anything of any consequence. And I hope that's the beginning of a trend.
By the end of last week, President Obama and congressional Democrats had agreed to $4 billion in current spending cuts to keep the federal government running for another 2 weeks. And there were signs that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell would see the trend continue, with longer-term compromise on Republicans' demand for a $60 billion reduction through the end of the fiscal year. But Obama's cut-with-caution approach also gained some credibility, with unexpectedly good economic news, even at current levels of government support and stimulation spending. 192,000 new jobs added last month, and a two-year low unemployment rate of 8.9%.
Washington's budget battle was driven by politics as well as economics. Longtime Republican leaders were dealing with pressures from a large contingent of Tea Party-prone House freshmen and with their party's 2012 prospects, as polls show significant division in public opinion. Majorities favor less spending in general, but not many of the specific cuts that would be required. And there was a warning that both parties would be blamed if a budget standoff brings a government shutdown.
With more on all those capital currents and more for your ears only, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a Newsweek contributor and author of several books, particularly noteworthy as Women's History Month gets underway. They are Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment and Madam President Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling. Thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be with you.
So is there yet a magic number for budget cuts on which both parties might compromise for spending cuts through September?
Well, for just this year's budget, they're about $50 billion apart. So I guess you would think there would be a compromise somewhere in the middle. But Vice President Biden, former senator, has been heading up those talks in the Senate, and he released just a one-sentence summary yesterday saying they were proceeding. So I don't think there's any breakthrough yet on the horizon.
What's your sense of House GOP leaders' ability to get Tea Party conservatives behind a compromise less than the $60 billion they came up with, which was less than the $100 billion that they were originally talking about? Where's the biggest challenge?
I think they've got to give the new Tea Party folks a lesson in reality, and that is, what can they get through the Senate? And I think they're going to tell them what they've been telling the public, that this is the first time a continuing resolution, a CR, which is designed to just short-term fund the government, has actually cut money, even though a lot of that money was fanciful. It was earmarks and it was things that even the president had suggested. It still is a change in sort of the Washington culture and attitude. So I think what the speaker is going to do is tell the Tea Party people they're winning, even though they may feel like they're not winning.
What's the reaction on both sides of the aisle to last week's good economic news, apart from the fear of rising oil prices? Are Republicans starting to worry that Obama's policies may work, both for job growth and his reelection prospects?
Well, they should start to worry, but I think mostly they focus on raising all of the things that could still go wrong, and that's the unease in the Middle East and the impact that might have on gas prices. And I think people around the country are beginning to see gas prices approaching $4, which makes everybody very nervous. But I think the administration finally has a good story to tell, and that is that the private sector is beginning to kick in and to produce some jobs. And I think the administration's forecast that the unemployment rate could be in the low eights by Election Day in 2012, while that's still unacceptably high, if it's heading in the right direction, I think this president's going to be hard to beat. And you look at the reluctance of the various rumored presidential candidates on the Republican side to actually get in the race, and I think the president looking a little stronger probably has something to do with that.
Well, speaking of that, Fox News last week suspended two potential presidential candidates from its bench of commentators, Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. Newt actually launched a website to test the waters and collect donations, although didn't go as far as announcing his candidacy. Another poll shows Mike Huckabee, still a Fox regular, with most support among Republicans, 25%. 5% versus only 13% for Gingrich, 12% for Sarah Palin, who is still on Fox. What does that tell you about presidential currents and the policies at Fox?
That tells me that the Fox News people think that Mike Huckabee and Sarah Palin really aren't going to run. And Mike Huckabee is interested mostly in selling books. He's got a new book out, and he's been saying a lot of sort of controversial things, I think, to boost his book sales. And Sarah Palin will probably be a tease in the race for some time. But in the end, she may. I think they're betting that she's not going to run. And both Palin and Huckabee are pretty candid about the fact that they don't want to give up the nice fat income that they get from Fox just to, you know, get into a primary with a dozen other candidates that may lead nowhere.
Moderate Mitt Romney is number two in that same poll with 21%, despite a lot of criticism over his Obama-style health care reform as governor of Massachusetts. How do you see his prospects for nomination and Tea Party influence on the race versus the need for general electorate appeal?
Yeah, Romney would be the choice of the sort of mainstream Republicans, and Huckabee would be the choice of the Tea Party folks. If Huckabee doesn't get in, you know, where do the Tea Party people go? And I think it's a race really between Romney and Tim Pawlenty. And Pawlenty, the former Minnesota governor, and he's been really making more of an effort to court the right than Romney has been making. Or I guess Romney's been doing some of it too, but it comes across as even more insincere from Romney than from Pawlenty. I do think those are the two candidates that are most likely to be the real contenders for the nomination if somebody like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in the end doesn't get in.
Finally, as we begin Women's History Month, we'd be remiss not to ask you about the role of women in the new Congress, especially in the House Republican majority, and about the actual influence retained by Nancy Pelosi and other women on the Democratic side.
Well, on the Republican side, they do have a one woman in the leadership. She's a vice chair. She's from Washington State, Kathy McMorris Rodgers. But I would probably defy most of your listeners. Probably many people haven't heard from her. She has not been out front. And then they do have one full committee chairperson, Elena Ross-Lehtinen, who heads up foreign relations. And that is a significant post. And because Ross-Lehtinen is so supportive of the embargo on Cuba that any efforts to lift that embargo, I think, have probably been stalled. On the Democratic side, you know, Nancy Pelosi is out there, you know, fighting and generally from the left and from the progressive side, but she does not get the attention that she did when she was Speaker. And I think the Democratic women have been most prominent in the last week or 10 days trying to fight back the Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood. And if there have been any Republican women joining that effort, I sure haven't seen them.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a Newsweek contributor and author of Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment and Madam President, Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling.
Quote from the news, my first thought was eight justices don't have the common sense God gave a goat. That was Albert Snyder after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 8-1 in favor of the Westboro Baptist Church's First Amendment right to demonstrate at military funerals, Snyder's sons among them, with hateful signs such as God hates dead soldiers to proclaim the nation's moral decay. Justice Alito was the lone dissenter.
Next, Rethinking Afghanistan, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
We're all going to die one day, but we have to take revenge for our young children from these infidels.
In my opinion, any future defense secretary who advises the president to again send a big American land army into Asia or into the Middle East or Africa should have his head examined, as General MacArthur so delicately put it.
Afghanis outraged by yet another NATO attack last week that killed nine children collecting firewood in Kunar province later drew an apology from General David Petraeus, top general at the Pentagon Central Command, and his promise to investigate the mistake. But the larger mistake in Afghanistan, many think, was implied by Defense Secretary Robert Gates in an earlier speech at West Point. following current U.S. strategy there in the first place, or second or third place, given all our prior approaches there.
With questions about actual progress versus promise in Afghanistan steadily growing and public support for the war shrinking in recent polls, while a budget battle rages in Washington, many besides Gates are calling for a rethinking of strategy in Afghanistan for the larger threat of violent Islamic extremism around the world and across the United States. Among those pondering the options is a frequent guest on this show, Thomas Henriksen, Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and author most recently of American Power After the Berlin Wall. And he joins us again now for Your Ears Only. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you.
U.S. forces recently pulled out of the Peck Valley that had previously been portrayed as a critical arena for chasing down and neutralizing Taliban fighters. It was explained that our men could do more good protecting Afghan population centers. Does that suggest that a change in strategy or at least tactics is already underway?
No, I don't think so. We've been doing this, some of this, since General McChrystal was in charge when he came into Afghanistan in 2009 and was there for a year before the scandal brought him down. He had planned strategies to pull out certain troops in areas which were underpopulated and concentrating on protecting people in larger areas. That's not necessarily a bad strategy when you have limited sources and resources to apply.
Remind us of the top-level administration debate, a division, really, over what Afghan strategy to employ, two distinct approaches, and which was chosen.
Back when President Obama was considering whether to increase the number of forces in the fall of 2009, there was a debate that raged, and I think it was a healthy debate, between various sides. And for clarity, it's easy to speak in black and white polls, and to say on the one hand we have the counterinsurgency strategy that's being followed in Afghanistan, which is overlaid with heavy nation-building aspects to it, standing up armies, training people to do all sorts of things, building bridges and water treatment plants and hydroelectric dams and so forth. And then a more limited strategy on the opposite pole, which was called counterterrorism. The counterterrorism strategy was to rely on military strikes on particularly al-Qaeda, less so the Taliban, to go after terrorist networks, and deploy fewer ground troops to do less building and attempt to train in a very speeded-up fashion a large Afghan army to defend itself. My feeling is the two poles are pretty far apart, and I would favor going toward the middle a little bit, reducing the number of troops, less development projects, and a strategy eventually to get out of Afghanistan, which is a constant drain. It's becoming an ulcer for the United States.
Obama has promised to dump the current strategy if it's not clearly working well and quickly enough. Do your military sources think he has enough gumption and popular support to really do that?
I think it's going to be difficult. It's not a clear sort of split that happened back, say, during the Truman administration. MacArthur really clearly violated what the administration wanted to do by pressing the attack against China in North Korea. Here we have a kind of the military and there's a military of, meeting of the minds, so to speak, on what to do if we pull out and this place reverts back into a so-called swamp, to use a fashionable term, back about 5 years ago, that al-Qaeda will come in and al-Qaeda will set up a base. So it's really a hard debate on what exactly will work rather than one side sort of pulling out on the other or Obama abandoning a strategy.
What about the argument that even precisely targeted special operation attacks on terrorist bases and leaders cannot kill all those who are now or likely will be drawn to the terrorist cause? Critics say every successful strike, and especially accidents and collateral damage among civilians, breeds more would-be martyrs bent on revenge. They say we'd be better served by spending our defense money on defense, port and border security, deeper domestic intelligence, promoting more cooperation by the American Muslim community.
Well, I think there's what is going to have to happen. Our defenses have to get better. They are much better. The war in Afghanistan and war in Iraq, as popular as it was, did buy us some time to stand up a much better intelligence, a much better defensive network. There always will be some need for an offensive capability, only to keep your adversaries off balance. So I don't think we can completely have either or again. It'll probably come to a way of fighting this war against terror in such a way that it's not so hugely expensive, particularly in blood and treasure. And so consequently, it's going to take more of a calibration rather than a dramatic change, like switching a light switch to on or off.
Given the escalating violence in Libya right now, what about the viability and wisdom of direct U.S. military intervention or a no-fly zone, which Defense Secretary Gates has warned would require at least air attacks on anti-aircraft sites, an act of war?
Well, once again, I share Secretary Gates's caution. We don't want to get into a situation where it's a thin end of a wedge. We began very small, and the first thing we know, we're bogged down into another war in another Arab land. Standing up a air defense, of course, is a big undertaking, and sometimes I think we civilians think, because the military is very good and they can do these things well, we just have to snap our fingers and things will fall into place. But it's actually quite an event. And also there's the object of the concern that this will lead to the military being left with some sort of bag or lots of body bags if things go wrong, and they'll be stuck with another war again in Asia or in Africa or in some other remote area from the American heartland. And so there's a real concern here. And also it's not clear that Gaddafi is really using his air force to carry out most of his attacks on the democracy movement. So far, it tends to be his militias that have done this. And so consequently, again, it may not be the best option just to shut down his few airplanes.
Thomas Hendrickson is a Hoover Institution senior fellow at Stanford and author most recently of American Power After the Berlin Wall. His thoughts on rethinking strategy in Afghanistan were drawn from a 70-page report requested by the U.S. Joint Special Operations University.
Quote from the news, "We have to take responsibility just as he's taking responsibility." That was President Obama at a session with Mexican President Calderon, acknowledging that the U.S. is the major market for drug trafficking from Mexico. Obama also attempted to ease tensions by modifying restrictions on Mexican trucks crossing the U.S. border.
Next, a multifaceted singer-songwriter goes back to her country roots. For Your Ears Only.
With more for Your Ears Only, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
Some people do as they are told and never ask why. Stirring up trouble where I can.
Kicking the Beehive is the title track on a new album of original country songs by the shape-shifting singer-songwriter Susan Werner. She's already created albums of new songs that capture the spirit of old standards by Gershwin and Porter and of what she calls agnostic gospel, and another that mixes classic rock and the classics, Stevie Wonder with Chopin, Cat Stevens with Bach. The new album easily erases boundaries between blues, alt-country, jazz, and acoustic, while telling stories about homelessness, autism, the right to couples of any sex to marry, and sex itself.
The musical journey was based on a real pilgrimage that Werner undertook from Memphis to New Orleans, then recording in Nashville with all-star guest artists, including Vince Gill, Keb Moe, and Paul Franklin. To talk more about the trip, the songs it inspired, and the recording, for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to have Susan Werner with us now. Welcome to our little beehive.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, let's start with that title. It's nothing to do with Stieg Larsson's The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, but rather from self-improvement guru Dale Carnegie via your road manager.
Yeah, my road manager, the famous Jane, she always said to me, "What's the matter with you? Why are you always kicking the beehive?" And I'm like, what's that? And it was something that her dad used to say, because I think her dad took one of these Dale Carnegie salesman self-improvement courses, and the old saying evidently was, if you want to gather honey, don't kick over the beehive. And it shows a certain kind of restlessness, right, if you are a person who kicks the beehive, and I'm, I guess, an instigator at heart, and this song has already found its audience, I guess, among husbands and wives and friends who nudge each other during the show and say, that's you. That song is you.
Why did you feel it necessary to start with an actual Mississippi road trip?
I've done a lot of different styles of music over the years, but I've never taken my own trip to the South and down Highway 61 from Memphis down to New Orleans. And I felt like it was something I had to see for myself. I think sometimes the geography helps you understand and give some context to the sounds and the vocabulary that you hear when you listen to the blues and music of a certain era. So for me to go from Memphis down to Clarksdale on South on Highway 61, which is a two-lane road, most of it, to see the the crossroads between 61 and 49 and to go into Clarksville, Mississippi. When you see the fields, when you see the Mississippi Delta, the flatness of it, the richness of the soil, when you see how wide the Mississippi is down there, it helps to understand the blues and helps you get a sense of how real this time was, how real these people were, instead of being some kind of, you know, museum piece. Instead of that, people become real to you, and it also lets you become real in the music now when you write it in 2011.
As well as soaking up the mood and the music, you did some playing yourself along the way.
I did. I sat in at an open mic at Ground Zero, which is Morgan Freeman's great blues club there in Clarksdale. And boy, to sit in and try to pull a 12-bar blues in front of a room full of people who have high expectations, I had flop sweat like I haven't had in a very, very long time. And I'd recommend it to any musician to go down and see this for themselves, but really any American. There were so many people from Sweden and Finland and Italy and Australia. I mean, where were the Americans? It's a treasure we have that I think we don't fully take advantage of and fully celebrate.
Did your travels lead you to people with some of the painful problems you wrote songs about, a dying lover, an autistic child, homelessness, or was it more the blues mode itself?
I wanted to hear the music and get the music in my hands and then write the songs to make them contemporary. And the issues that I deal with, I guess, in some of the songs here are contemporary, but when you write them with materials that are traditional, I think it gives them a little extra emotional wallop when you realize that the things we suffer through today, there's a struggle to them, even if they're new issues. Pain and loneliness, these are old and eternal human situations, I guess.
Talk about the song Irrelevance. There's a personal truth for you in that song.
Yeah, someone misunderstood this and thought I was being entirely serious. They're like, well, irrelevance, you know, it's really, really difficult. But there is a gift in it. You know, there's a gift in these understandings, isn't there? That's what you write. And I'm being totally sarcastic in the song. Like, no one wants to accept that they're going to, you know, be eliminated from the surface of the earth. And the song basically tries to encourage us to laugh at something that otherwise we'd just break down and bawl our little eyes out over. And the trumpet player on this, we asked him over and over to play just worse. Like, just start out every phrase really brave and really confident and just to deteriorate. Which is maybe a metaphor for how many of us wind up living our lives.
There's also something of a tribute to the great songwriter Jimmy Webb in your track called Manhattan, Kansas. Talk about that.
The song has a town in the title, and it came to me that that was the melody. Manhattan, Kansas, we all do what we gotta do. There's a rhythm in the words Manhattan, Kansas, and a rhythm and a melody. And you think about many of the great songs of Jimmy Webb, who's such a wonderful songwriter and who has been kind to me in words that he's said and in interviews that he's given, which I appreciate so much. He has Wichita Lineman and Galveston, oh Galveston. Again, a rhythm and a melody in the title and a story in the song about everyday characters. And he gives their situations a certain kind of elegance. And I aspire to do something like that with this song.
We hear you're now at work on songs for a Broadway show. What can you tell us about the story or at least the challenge of writing that kind of music?
The great challenge of it is to write for characters who are not like you, maybe not like you at all, and to use their language, not to speak as yourself, but to speak as they speak with their experiences, maybe where they're from regionally. And to use music that expresses who they are physically, essentially, even sexually. I mean, what's their physical energy like? It takes imagination to do it, and it's rewarding when you feel like you begin to hone in on it. It's really exciting to see a character come to life in music. And, of course, writing trios and duos and ensemble pieces. I mean, this is the kind of thing you don't get to do for yourself as a singer-songwriter. You're singing up there just by yourself as a solo performer. But when the trios and the duos start to come to life, it is really, really thrilling.
Singer-songwriter Susan Werner's new CD is Kicking the Beehive, just released by Chance Music and Sleeve Dog Records. Check it out at SusanWerner.com. And here's a bit more.
My little boy doesn't quite fit in. Schools and rules were never made for him. My different son. My different son.
Next, MS in the Mind, a psychotherapist on chronic pain for your ears only. We'll be right back.
We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this news quote. We all know it is Jewish penicillin. That was Rabbi David Leon reporting on Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords' healthy appetite for matzo ball soup as she recovers from the bullet fired through her brain. Giffords also reportedly sang American Pie as she continues to recuperate.
One can think about treatment options for multiple sclerosis in four different categories. The first is treatment for attacks or exacerbations of the disease. The second is treatments that try to prevent the disease from getting worse over time. Third is treatment for symptoms. And fourth are future treatments for repair of nervous system damage.
One area of treatment for patients with multiple sclerosis not mentioned by Dr. Dean Winterchunk of the Mayo Clinic in Arizona is the psychological, the terrible emotional burden of coping with a chronic, often disabling and degenerative disease that now affects approximately 400,000 Americans and 10,000 more each year.
All too often, the mental side effects of MS can be almost as debilitating as the disease itself. Coinciding with the start of March as Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, licensed psychologist, anxiety, and disability consultant Patricia Farrell has a new book out to let MS patients, their families, and others with chronic pain know there is hope and ways to cope. The book is It's Not All in Your Head, Anxiety, Depression, Mood Swings, and Multiple Sclerosis from Demos Health Publishers. And to discuss it for your ears only, Dr. Farrell joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Well, nice to be with you today.
First, remind us what multiple sclerosis is, the major physical symptoms and disabilities.
Sure. Multiple sclerosis is actually an autoimmune disorder where the body, instead of protecting you, attacks a very specific part of your body. Your nerves are covered by a delicate membrane, and what happens is the autoimmune system, when it's in this kind of attack mode, mistakes your body for attacking bacteria, whatever, and it starts to inflame and destroy that covering, which then results in all kinds of things. Now, part of the problem with multiple sclerosis is that there are so many symptoms, and sometimes they wax and wane with long periods in between, and it's difficult to diagnose these unless you go to a neurologist and you have very specific tests made. But primarily, one of the first things is people begin to have some vision problems. Then they have muscle weakness. Maybe they have a stiffness. There's an impairment, maybe in sensitivity to certain touch, pain. Usually there's some walking difficulties. Maintaining your balance is a big one. There may even be bowel and bladder problems. And, of course, then there are these mood changes which come on unexpectedly. And some people even begin to laugh hysterically out loud for no reason. And, unfortunately, sometimes this is seen as either dementia or a psychosis, which is really, really extremely serious condition, you know, if that is mistaken for that. So we want to look out for that. But on the other hand, we have cognitive impairments, and generally MS hits younger women, primarily women, although men get it too, and kids get it also, a little more less, we see it in children, but adults, women, in their childbearing years will begin to have these kinds of symptoms, and they'll have good days and bad days, and primarily it affects memory, concentration, the ability to organize, to maintain your attention, sometimes even to use appropriate language. And there again, we're in an area that it can be mistaken for something else, so you really have to go to a specialist. And sometimes it's just very difficult for them to maintain their mood and to be reasonable. And people can become extremely irritable for almost no reason at all. I mean, I've heard people, a man turn around and say to his wife after 50 years of marriage, "Get out of the house. I don't want you here anymore." Now, he didn't mean that. That was his disease speaking. And this places these people in a great, great amount of turmoil.
Some people might say that confronting the reality of having MS, it might logically lead to depression and anxiety. But you have found that those conditions themselves are part of the degenerative process, biologically driven. Talk about that.
Yes, they are. I think a lot of people don't realize that the immune system actually modulates our emotional state, our depression and anxiety, and it's really not clear why that happens. All the researchers I spoke to said, we now know that that's there, and it's not that you know you have MS, it's that the disease process itself is causing this. And that's the reason that when you go to someone and they give you a medication for anxiety or, let's say, depression primarily, it doesn't really work. And now the person wonders why, and they begin to feel that they're helpless. And you have to remember, the mind-body connection is so strong that when you start to believe something and you start to get depressed because you feel you're in a hopeless situation, that medication's not helping and you're not getting any better, look what it does. We know that stress works in a negative fashion on the immune system. So if you start feeling depressed, you start getting depressed, then your immune system starts working again in the wrong way against you. And so what it does is it exacerbates your illness. So the best thing you can do is maintain an optimistic attitude. And I know that can sometimes be very difficult.
Dr. Patricia A. Farrell is a licensed clinical psychologist and author, most recently of It's Not All in Your Head, Anxiety, Depression, Mood Swings, and Multiple Sclerosis from Demos Health Publishers. Her website is drfarrell.net.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. I just didn't want to miss today. That was Apple CEO Steve Jobs on showing up for the launch of the iPad 2, his first appearance since beginning an indeterminate medical leave, but looking no worse than when last seen.
Hear For Your Ears Only anytime at iTunes, News and Politics, or podcastbunker.com. To support our show with tax-deductible donations or grants, write davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Paul Ruest at Argo Studios. With intern Kate McGee, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of GateWave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see. Learn how you can benefit or help at gatewave.org.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kate McGee. This week last year, as President Obama pressed for congressional action on health care reform, we considered a survey by doctors themselves of worst practices that could be minimized to cut costs and improve patient outcomes from our March 7th Newsweek On Air broadcast hosted by David and Melissa Exelberth.
Now's the time to make a decision about how to finally reform health care so that it works. Not just for the insurance companies, but for America's families and America's businesses.
I noticed he didn't mention the $500 trillion in Medicare cuts. He didn't mention the $500 trillion in $500 billion, $500 trillion in new taxes.
President Obama last week again pressed his prescription for health care reform, this time adding a few features generally favored by Republicans. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell continued to speak for a unified GOP opposition to the president's appeal. While the political leaders argue cost and coverage, however, some physicians are working on their own approach to saving money and maybe lives, pinpointing those medical procedures that accomplish least for their cost and can actually put patients in greater danger than if they were avoided. By one estimate, some 30,000 Americans die every year from unnecessary care.
According to Dr. Howard Brody, a family physician at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, an estimated one-fifth to one-third of U.S. health care costs, $500 billion to $700 billion, goes toward diagnostics and treatments with no real benefit to patients. Routine CT scans and x-rays for everyone who shows up in an emergency room, pap tests for cervical cancer in women who no longer have a cervix. In a recent New England Journal of Medicine article, Dr. Brody proposed that every medical specialty identify five such procedures. And he joins us now to talk about it. Also with us is Newsweek Science editor Sharon Begley.
First, Dr. Brody, welcome to Newsweek on Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Was there a specific incident or case that prompted you to make this proposal?
Well, over this last year, I've been seeing a number of op-eds written by physicians in the media. And the theme that's common to most of these is, I have a scanner that I own in my office, and I'm absolutely sure that I don't do any unnecessary scans. Every scan I do is really good for the patient. And if you know the data, the scientific evidence is that if you own your own scanner, you're probably going to do at least twice as many scans as doctors who don't. So it's really a question about whether owning a scanner in your office is one of those things that leads to overuse of technology. And yet these doctors were writing in these op-ed pieces basically trying to scare their patients to think if the government came along and imposed these new limits on you, whatever the limit was they were talking about, your health care would be threatened. You might die because you didn't get this scan that I could offer you. And trying to turn patients into lobbyists out of fear to get them to help doctors protect their incomes struck me as a real low point in professional standards. And the thousands of doctors out there who really care about their patients and know the patient is supposed to come first are not being well represented by this small group of physicians, in my view.
Why only five worst practices per specialty?
The reason I chose the number five was a guesstimate. I thought that if we could easily, in most specialties, go to 10 or 15 if we tried. But I'm a strong proponent of comparative effectiveness research, which is doing more research to get strong data to show us which things work and which don't. And I was making a guesstimate that if we stuck with five, we'd have the ones that were non-controversial, where there was really good evidence already that they didn't work. And if we tried to go to 15, we'd have to get new evidence to really prove it.
Cost is foremost in everyone's consciousness during this reform debate, but we've mentioned the safety factor as well. How could a benign test or a scan be dangerous?
Let me give you two quick examples from CAT scanning, which a lot of people agree is tremendously overused today. We're starting to become aware that a typical abdominal CAT scan has as much radiation as 500 chest x-rays. And so people are starting to calculate the cancer risks that we're putting our people under, especially the younger people who are exposed to multiple CAT scans. But what people generally don't realize, and we see commonly in medicine, is when you do a scan on a relatively healthy patient who doesn't really need it, you're much likelier to turn up a false finding than a true finding, and you may end up having to do surgery or some really invasive measure to find out that it was false. So the patient could actually suffer a considerable health consequences as a result of that scan.
Dr. Howard Brody at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. Next to Newsweek's Sharon Begley, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, David.
You contacted medical specialty groups about Dr. Brody's proposal. What was the reaction overall?
Well, they ranged from one extreme to the other. One group, namely dermatologists, said, no, nothing we do fails to benefit patients. And at the other end, I spoke to the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and she said, only five? I can, you know, just turn me on. I can give you a dozen that we do in the emergency room that are not helpful to patients.
One nomination involves what you call nth-line chemotherapy. What's that, and why a worst practice?
This is something that the president of ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, suggested to me. And his point is that once patients have not responded, once their cancer has not responded to the second or third line therapy, chemotherapy, it's probably not helpful for them to get a fourth or a fifth or in some cases even a sixth chemotherapy agent. And the reason is they have an extremely low chance of benefiting, an extremely low chance that their cancer will respond, but chemotherapies are very toxic, so they have a high chance of having their life actually shortened by taking another chemotherapy agent.
The internal medicine specialist had more than a handful of nominations. Give us some examples and explanations.
Yeah, these guys were, you know, really gung-ho. The most obvious one is antibiotics for upper respiratory tract infections. You know, the patient shows up with a runny nose and a cold and refuses to leave the doctor without a prescription for antibiotics. Antibiotics do not kill the viruses that cause colds. They kill bacteria, so they're useless on colds. They also suggested Me Too drugs that are no more effective than the older versions. If you have hypertension, the first thing your doctor should be prescribing is a diuretic. Only if you don't respond to that should the, you know, the more expensive ones be enlisted. And he also had a number of high-tech tests. You know, Dr. Brody mentioned CT scans. That is in everybody's crosshairs. But this physician also mentioned something that's very popular, coronary calcium scans. The idea is to see if there are calcium buildups in your arteries. And the basic answer is, whatever they find does not affect the advice and the treatment that the doctor offers you.
There's even a question about the tiny stents implanted to keep arteries open, like we just heard with some of our major political figures.
Yes. Well, this is a hugely controversial one. Not controversial in the science, because four, and then most recently a fifth, huge clinical trials have shown that, except in an emergency, if you insert a stent to prop open a clogged artery, it does not reduce the risk that that patient will eventually die of a heart attack. It does not reduce the risk that that patient will even have a heart attack any better than treating with drugs first. But, of course, doing the procedure, inserting the stents, is so much more lucrative for physicians that something like 500,000 elective angioplasties are done every year, and the huge proportion of those are not medically necessary.
Sharon Begley is Newsweek science editor. We also heard from Dr. Howard Brody at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston.
Worst practices from our March 7th, 2010 Newsweek on-air broadcast. Last week, a federal judge stayed his decision invalidating the new health care reform legislation after finding the individual insurance mandate unconstitutional. President Obama, speaking to governors, offered to move up by 3 years the granting of waivers for states that come up with plans of their own, if they covered as many people at least as well and as affordably for individuals and the federal budget. Critics said those requirements would be actually impossible to meet. I'm Kate McGee. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, singer-songwriter Susan Werner again in an appropriately medical vein.
Doctor, doctor, this just can't be. I can't believe this news you're telling me. Doctor, doctor, you've got it wrong. She looks so well, so very healthy and strong. And she's the sun, she's everything. She holds my heart, she wears my ring. Don't take her away. Don't take my baby away. She means the world to me. My whole world, can't you see? Don't take my baby away. Don't take my baby away. Take everything I own. My work, my pride, my home. But don't take my baby away. By all these numbers and these words you use, I know you're trying to help. Forgive me, doctor, I'm beside myself. 'Cause she's the sun, she's everything. She holds my heart, she wears my ring. Don't take her away. Take my baby away. She means the world to me. My whole world, can't you see? Don't take my baby away. Don't take. everything I own. My work, my pride, my home. But don't take my baby, she's the warmth inside my bed. She's the calm inside my head. She's the meaning of success. She's my every happiness, yeah. She means the world to me, my whole world, can't you see? Don't take my baby away, don't take my baby away. Take everything I own, my work, my pride, my home. But don't take my baby, don't take my baby, don't take my baby away.